Come chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat with Nick.
Hey everyone. Today we've got DP Knutten, who is an acclaimed author, but also a thorough, brand man through and through. Lots of experience, great hair, great beard, and some cool guitars behind him. So we're going to definitely hear about that. But DP, let's just start with where on earth are you?
All right. Well, for those of you who are not habitués of the United States of America, let me describe it. You know the basic shape of America? If you go straight to the middle and then go kind of straight up and a little bit to the east, you're going to end up in the Great Lakes region where you might know Chicago, right? Chicago to the Windy City. We're about 2.5 hours from Chicago in Wisconsin. The capital city of the state of Wisconsin is Madison, Wisconsin. And believe it or not, I'm just a little bit outside of that in a place called Sun Prairie, which happens to be the birthplace of Georgia O'Keeffe, the great painter.
So she's quite, I think people either love her or hate her. And I think she's had obviously a resurgence over the past couple of years. Now, you've said all sorts of words. I've seen your mouth move, but I still don't know where you live. So basically in the middle where it's cold in the States.
Well, it's right now we've had a combination of 110 degrees Fahrenheit and a cool 73 degrees Fahrenheit. But in the winter, we'll get down to 0 Fahrenheit or below 0 Fahrenheit, like as low as minus 25. So we have these incredible temperature swings from summer to winter. And frankly, that's what makes us Midwestern Americans so tough.
Well, again, your mouth is moving and you're using these weird words like Fahrenheit. How much is that in monkeys or turkey necks?
let me just say Celsius. Okay, so Celsius, we've had 40 plus degrees Celsius this summer already. And wow. We'll have negative 20 Celsius in winter.
Okay. So basically, it's the Siberia of the States, because it has similar temperature swings. I mean, do you have mosquitoes as well?
Oh, my God. It's the state bird of the state of Wisconsin. And believe me, they're big enough that if they get enough of you on your arms, they can fly away with you. I mean, yeah, it can be really bad.
Well, okay, enough about the geography lesson. So let's go into a bit of your background. Why should we listen to you, DP?
Because I'm an opinionated American. Isn't that good enough? No, I'm sorry.
It's a starting point. It's a starting point.
No, okay. Well, what you should know is I got into advertising and marketing through the fact that I couldn't do anything else and get paid for it. And what I mean by that is I got a degree in theater. I wanted to be an actor. I did improv comedy. I did on camera. I did voiceover. I did you name it. And then I decided, you know, late 20s, that I actually wanted to get married and have children. And for some reason, women just were not attracted to someone who couldn't get a paycheck. So what am I going to do? Literally, what am I going to do to get that paycheck? Well, I looked around at my skill set and said, well, I've noticed that I write better than 90% of humanity. And, you know, that might be generous, but still, I was known for being able to write well. My improv comedy background kind of gave me a certain facility with the English language so that I could create that kind of sharp, punchy stuff that advertising wanted in the form of headlines or concepts. You know, I was very quick on my feet. And so I kind of stumbled into advertising, and that was 30 years ago. I started at a small agency in Denver, Colorado. And then ended up in Atlanta, Georgia, working on a brand that I think everybody knows, Coca-Cola, as a young copywriter. And frankly, that's where I went to grad school, if you will, for branding. Because if you can sell sweet, brown, bubbly water and convince the world that it is one of the greatest things ever, then you know exactly what branding is. If you follow the recipe that they created for creating a brand. And so that became kind of the foundation for my love of brand, my fascination with brand.
I've just got to give my own little Coca-Cola story. For about 5 years after about 2 years after working with Coca-Cola, I still had that the Coca-Cola red Pantone swatch in my wallet just in case, because they were crazy about that. Every single piece of printed material, so I know that I could probably rattle off that Pantone. It is a lot of people have graduated out of Unilever and Coca-Cola, becoming real good at what they're doing.
Well, and I attribute that to the fact that they understand one thing. They came out nationwide in the United States in 1886 with Coca-Cola. 1 year later, 1887, Pepsi started invading every state of the United States. And they understood one thing. One, we have first mover status, which is incredibly important. If you are the first mover in any sector, you can command that sector if you defend your position in that sector and never, ever forget what your brand is. So they understood very, very clearly. And I one of the things I do in my presentations all the time is create a simple quadrant chart with two axes. You know, one is authenticity, the other is synthenticity, if that's even a word, and then timeless and trendy. Well, you then plug the logos in for Coca-Cola and Pepsi, and they're in entirely different quadrants on that quadrant chart. They occupy different places in your brain because Coca-Cola has always, always, always been telling us that they're the real thing, that they are the thing you enjoy with family and friends, at parties, at football games, wherever you are. Coca-Cola is a part of that. Meanwhile, at least in the United States, I didn't work on Pepsi, so I don't know the whole global strategy for Pepsi. But here in the United States, Pepsi has always associated themselves with whoever the biggest pop star singer is or whoever the coolest celebrities are in the culture. And they always want to try to attract the youth. Here in the United States, one of their big taglines was the taste of a new generation. They always wanted to associate themselves with youth, where Coca-Cola always wanted to own family and multi-generations of family. So much so that they own an entire holiday period of the year, at least in the United States, when it comes to Christmas time. And the use of the red and white Santa. Yeah, again, around the world, we all have some version of Sinterklaas or Santa Claus or something like that, at least for the people who follow the Christian faith or are adjacent to it.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like to point out is that our current idea of what Santa Claus looks like here in the United States is based on an illustration for Coca-Cola that was created in 1933 by a guy named Harold Sunblom. That image of a fat, you know, Santa Claus kicking back with a Coca-Cola is still kind of ingrained in the DNA of everything that people associate with the Christmas time period. And consequently, if you're having family over for a Christmas holiday celebration, you may not drink soft drinks like Coca-Cola at all, but you're going to buy some because someone in your family is going to come and say, "Hey, do you guys have a Coca-Cola?" And the answer is always yes, because it's the real thing. And it has been since 1886.
Well, that's a fascinating backstory. And your point on Santa Claus is quite right. I mean, the brand itself is basically, you know, created this new character. And, you know, it's not just in the States, like you mentioned, and Christian countries, but Japan also sees Father Christmas and that as this, you know, American export. But I've been quite lucky to work with Coca-Cola across Africa and the subcontinent, but then also with PepsiCo in places like the Middle East. But I've worked in Pakistan, Malaysia, a variety of other places, and Pepsi would be dominant in those places. So I'm in Norway right now, and Coca-Cola is the poor cousin to Pepsi, which is ridiculous. We drink the most Pepsi Max in the world. And when you go to Bangladesh and to Pakistan, it's all Pepsi. So it's very interesting seeing which markets Coca-Cola is dominated and which markets Pepsi is dominated, and the way they position themselves in those markets. And it's been fascinating seeing: are you a Pepsi country or are you a Coca-Cola country?
And the fascinating thing is their flavor profiles between the two soft drinks is not that different. I mean, yeah, what Pepsi is a little sweeter than and Coke's a little bit more acidic, but a lot of people who enjoy foods will say Coke is better to drink with food because the acidity of it will like take the oily fat off your tongue so you can actually taste food more and better than the sweet cloying taste of Pepsi. So, but the whole point is they're both sweet, brown, bubbly water. And yet it's gotten to the point where you're a loyalist of one or the other to the exclusion of the other. You know, Here in the United States, it's very common that if a waiter comes to you in a restaurant and says, "What can I get you to drink?" And you'd say, "I'd like a Coca-Cola." They might say, "Oh, I'm sorry. We only serve Pepsi products." To which someone in your party is going to say, "Oh, that's okay. I'll just have water." Why? Because they're a brand loyalist to the point of the exclusion of the other brand when their favorite brand is not available. That, to me, is the power of branding.
Absolutely. I was like that. I had never, a Pepsi had never passed my lips before I moved to Malaysia. And I got PepsiCo as a client there, or one of the bottlers of Pepsi there. And I was forced to drink my first Pepsi. And because I'm a brand person, I decided, okay, this is my client, I will only drink Pepsi now. So it was a bit of a transition. I felt like I was letting the family down. Because to tell a backstory on Coca-Cola as well, Coca-Cola was supplied to the troops during the Second World War. And that's how a lot of, you know, my grandfather's or your grandfather's generation got hooked on Coke as well. Imagine being in battle and there's a Coca-Cola with, you know, sweet energy and giving you a bit of a boost and a taste of home. And that was brought back to all of these other Commonwealth countries as well. So in South Africa, but it was before that, in 1928, while my grandfather was at school, he remembers the Coca-Cola truck coming to the school and handing out the glass bottles and having his first Coca-Cola. And that's why I must drink Coca-Cola. My grandfather drank it, my grandma, and there was always, always a bottle of Coke in my grandparents' fridge.
And you just hit on something key. It's not about the fluid in the bottle. It's as much about the bottle itself and that place in your family ancestral lore. You may not think of it that way, but when I have a Coke, I think of my grandmother who lived in Kansas here in the United States, which is in the summer, it's 5 miles from hell in terms of heat. And let me tell you, as a little kid who'd be playing outside, I would go running in. She was an old Swede who refused to pay for air conditioning. So her house was like an oven. You come in the kitchen door. It's got a screen door slams. You reach in the refrigerator, which is so old, it doesn't have a light on the inside. You have to reach in and kind of fish your hand around until you found that unique shaped green glass bottle that was the absolute imprimatur of Coca-Cola. And the first thing I would do is not open it. I'd grab it and put it on my neck right next to my carotid artery because that would instantly refresh me. Coca-Cola was not about the liquid. It was about the refreshment. And that actually is something that is one of the pillars of Coca-Cola. And it taught me the power of a concept I call the key three, which is nicely alliterative or rhyming. And it has to do with the fact that any brand should be able to be summed up by three key concepts that are universally understood about them. And we can go into much more about that if you'd like.
Yeah, I think let's do that because a lot of times, and I've been dealing with students and clients for quite a while, and they try and pack 20 things into what the brand stands for, 20 things into the vision, 20 things into the mission. And to your point, I think the human, regular human being, can only retain 3 things in their brain.
Exactly.
When it comes to any message that's coming to them. And I try and say 3 or less, basically. Otherwise, it just goes over your head.
Well, and psychologically, in the way, again, like brains work, here in the United States, our telephone numbers are in groups of 3, 3, and 4. So my area code is 608, my prefix is 469, and then the last 4 numbers are the rest of my phone number. And that's how we think of it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
It's the rhythm of it, too. And it's that idea of creating a series. It's easy to remember 3 things. It's impossible to remember 25.
Yeah, that telephone rhyming thing is quite fascinating. And I'm sure people are saying their own number right now in their heads as they think about that. But let's talk about your book for a little bit. And what spurred you to write this fantastic thing called Nonfiction Brand? By D.P. Knutten.
Well, okay, this actually is related to Coca-Cola in some ways, because this happened, this actual nonfiction brand idea came to me when I was working as a young copywriter at McCann Erickson in Atlanta on brands like Coca-Cola. We all know what a creative brief is, right? It's the skinny or the details that you need to get started on a job. As a copywriter, and a creative brief could be 2 pages, it could be 200 pages, depending on the complexity of the project. As a copywriter, I only cared about the second page where they had a section called copy points. And there'd be a bullet point that says, buy one, get one free, supplies are limited from January 1st to January 30th only. See your local dealers, whatever. These are the facts that I have to consider. These are the must-haves, the requirements of the job. So that's what I look at first. And then I try to come up with the really fun, interesting, cool ideas that attract your eye and open your wallet. But first, I need to know what we're selling, right? Because I'm not the copywriter doesn't get to say what we're selling. You Yeah. have to tell me what we're selling. One day, and I kid you not, I got a creative brief where, and I would turn the page and look at that copy point spot, and it said, write some stuff. I'm like, what does that mean? Write some stuff. And so with a little bit of peek, I walk into the account director's office and I say, dude, what is this? Write some stuff. And then I said something that for some reason hit me in the head like a baseball bat. I said to him, I am not a fiction writer. And then I thought about that. Well, we got the job done and all that stuff, but I kept thinking about that. I'm not a fiction writer. And it's not that I can't write fiction that nobody wants to read. I can absolutely do that. But what I was saying was, when it comes to branding and marketing and advertising, I am not going to write pure fiction. You have to give me something. You have to give me a nonfiction fact upon which to create this communication. Mm. And the more I thought about it, I'm not a fiction writer. What am I? I'm a nonfiction writer. I'm a nonfiction brander. I believe in nonfiction branding. And then I started developing that idea over, 20 years, basically. And the book came about because the book was telling me it needed to be written. Well, and also the people I worked with as a creative director, they would always tell me, you got to write down what you're telling me right now. And I'm like, why? Because no one else, I never heard it framed that way. The idea that there is such a thing as a fiction brand and a nonfiction brand. I would ask your listeners to just think about the universe of branding and marketing and communications therein and say, hey, there are fiction brands out there. And there are nonfiction brands out there. Identify them and separate them into 2 buckets. And every single one of your listeners will go, oh, I get it. You know, like we all know that there are brands that are authentic and real and based on fact. And many of them are related directly with the founders of that that actual brand or the family that backs it up. You know, you look at some of the great, fantastic brands in Europe and Asia, and when they can say, well, we've had this same knife manufacturing firm going for 450 years. I'm sorry if you can say that. That's an incredible, strong nonfiction fact that you can build an entire brand off of, especially if you're aligning every part of your operations to support and defend that fact. You know, before we talked about the fact that Coca-Cola was the first mover in the marketplace when it comes to soft drinks based on cola in the United States. Well, that's a fact. That is true. And what they did was, we aren't going to just kind of refer to that. It's going to be one of the three pillars we base our brand upon. And again, Coca-Cola's done a little bit of migrating with what they do with their brand. But back when I worked on it, the thing that I would be held to, my feet would be held to the fire on, three things. How does this communicate authenticity, refreshment, and sociability? Now, again, I could give a masterclass on what those words mean, but suffice it to say that I could come up with the funniest ad, the most groundbreaking idea, and if I could not explain how it communicates authenticity, refreshment, and sociability, it was dead on arrival. Why? Coca-Cola understood our brand depends on our always defending our authentic place in the marketplace. We're the real thing. We were the first mover. We will always be that. Refreshment. That story I told about my grandma's house where you put that Coke bottle on your neck, the shape of the Coke bottle itself, part of the creative brief was, if you find a piece of this bottle broken on the ground, it should be recognizable as a Coca-Cola bottle. Part of the creative brief was that a glass shard should scream Coca-Cola. That to me is amazing. That's the length they understood they needed to go to defend their position. And then sociability, that word, what does that mean? You never drink Coke by yourself. You do it where everybody gathers, a football game, a picnic, a family holiday gathering. And even if you don't drink Coke yourself, you're going to buy it because my uncle drinks it. My grandchildren drink it. It's going to be part of the things on the table. You know, you're going to have some sparkling water. You'll have some still water. You'll have maybe a couple of different soft drinks, a lemon lime flavored soft drink, or you know, a cola. You're going to have a cola because someone's going to ask for a cola. Which cola should I get? Well, I'm going to get Coca-Cola in this case. So it's that idea of going back to the concept of the key three: authenticity, refreshment, sociability. Those things I've later codified into my, you know, my kind of coining of the key three. That's exactly what you have to have a brand. And every brand, I will posit that even the most complicated brand out there can be distilled down to three distinct phrases. Let me give you an example of that. There's a certain brand the entire world knows, not all of it loves it, but they know it. The United States of America is a brand the same way that Norway is a brand, the same way that South Africa is a brand, the same way that Canada is a brand. Every one of those countries has its own unique set of nonfiction brand qualities that really create the international image of what they are. The United States, we aren't always the best people on the planet, but we try to be. If you distill down the United States of America into our founding documents from, and these go all the way back to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States of America, you can say America at its best is all about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We don't always get it right. I'm not claiming we do, but we always strive toward it. And in fact, in the preamble of the Constitution of the United States of America, there's a phrase that I love that was written by Gouverneur Morris, I think was the guy who wrote it. In order to form a more perfect union, not a perfect union, but a more perfect or perfectible union, we will always be striving to become better. You will always have the opportunity to live your life and strive for happiness, pursue happiness and via liberty. And yeah. Let me tell you, as often as we get things wrong, we've got the best and brightest of every country around the world scrambling to find a way to get in here because they know that there is no caste system here. There's a little bit of a class system here, but it's you can come to the United States of America with the proverbial 25 cents in your pocket, and you can, by the age of 55, if you work hard, if you have a hell of a lot of luck, but you can rise to the level of whatever level you want to achieve, because we don't care about the things, the structures that may be found in other societies. Again, we don't always get it right, but at least we have those three principles to guide us. And one of the things, I know you know this, Nicholas, a brand is not the center line of the highway that you have to tiptoe down like you're on a tightrope. A brand are the guardrails that keep you from going off into the ditch or off the cliff. You're going to go back and forth. As market conditions change, you're going to have to weave a little bit. But a good brand will never, ever allow you to do a 90-degree turn off in another direction. And we can all think of brands right now that did that and have failed miserably. Yeah. Meanwhile, the ones that stayed their course, whatever their course happened to be, even if instead of going true north, they went a little bit northeast, they're still moving forward in a way that people can support and understand.
One of the things that people often use is that you want out-the-box thinking. But what this really is, as you said, guardrails, but thinking in the box. It's so much more complex to work within guardrails and within that box. But the exciting thing of finding new ways and expression of those three points of Coca-Cola, for example, new ways of and exciting ways of turning them on their head, but still keeping them, I think is what creatives hate briefs where you said, just write something. You've got carte blanche, do what you want. And I do it the whole, and I'm very guilty of that with my team sometimes. But the best brief is a very sharp brief saying, you know, what you can't do versus what you can do.
I will go even further and say something that a lot of creatives would consider heretical. If anything is possible, nothing is. Literally, if you are an artist as a creative, you need parameters. Michelangelo carving David had the parameters of a block of granite or a block of marble. And within that, what was the famous quote Michelangelo said about David? He was already in there. I discovered him inside the block. David did not exist outside the block, the parameters of the block. You think about any fine artist, where do they start? Oh, I'm going to paint something that, no, they're going to grab a canvas or a piece of media, and they're going to have various, you know, parameters. Every director of a feature film in Hollywood has very severe parameters in the form of an aspect ratio of a film camera or a digital camera. And resolution and things like color palettes, and they have so many restrictions. And guess what happens with restrictions? Creativity.
Yeah.
You know, necessity is the mother of invention. Yeah, it is the mother of invention. But it's parameters are the father of invention. The stern father who says, you can't do that, you can do that, but you can't do that, but you can do that. Okay, stern dad. Well, guess what? I'm going to take your rules and I'm going to bend them like Keanu Reeves in The Matrix. And I'm not going to break the system, but I'm going to bend them. Think of a fine artist like Banksy. how does the guy who nobody knows who he is get known throughout the entire world? And then my favorite thing he ever did was that Sotheby's auction, or maybe it was Christie's, where they a girl with the balloon, and all of a sudden after it sells, it starts being shredded. When I saw that happen, I said, guess what? The person who just paid $450,000 for that just made millions, because the entire act itself was part of the creation of that event, that experience. If you said to me, which one do you want? Do you want the one that's intact with the nice gold frame? Or do you want the one with the shards that are, you know, the little hanging things underneath? I would say, give me the hanging one, because I know someone's going to buy that for $5 million, which I think somebody just did.
I'm just going to talk about art quickly, because you brought up Banksy, and Damien Hirst had this wonderful sculpture exhibition of the submerged statues. I'm not sure if you saw it.
Yes.
And I've been struggling for years to find new art or something that really, an idea that captivates me. And they released it like a documentary, like they found these ancient statues underground. I mean, that's been underwater for hundreds or thousands of years. And it was absolutely the most wonderful piece of art I've ever seen. And then I saw, wait a minute, there's Mickey Mouse ears and there's an alien. But it totally transfixed me. It was just a magnificent spectacle and one of the most exciting things in art I've ever seen. That's what I'm going to, I just wanted to make a quick segue for anyone who hasn't seen it. I'll put the link in. But just in terms of art, what a wonderful
concept.
And
that's what a creative artist does. It subverts expectations. Like, oh, I expect it to look like some Greek hero, you know, someone holding Medusa's head or something, and you go, oh no, that's Mickey Mouse's, Minnie Mouse's head that he's holding, or something like that.
Exactly.
It's that subversion, that disruption, that, oh my God, you're actually creating messaging on multiple layers that can be subject to everybody's individual interpretation.
Now,
that to me is great art.
But now, DP, talking about individual interpretation, it takes us into how much control do brands nowadays have over their brands.
Okay. I want you to think about this for a second. They have a tremendous amount of control over their brands when they realize who all the owners of the brand are. Because in the old, good old days, you know this, the ad agency working for whoever, they were the owners of the brand. They would define the brand. They would communicate the brand. They would defend the brand in, you know, over the limited number of broadcast television channels or radio that was available, they would own. And it was very much, I'm shoving this at you. I'm push marketing. I'm shoving at you. Well, the reality is, and this was kind of a groundbreaking thing, I think started about 20 years ago, but it's now just, you know, regular operating procedure for people. We understand the owners of the brand are, yes, the people who own the IP, the intellectual property, the copyrights, the patents, if the patents are involved, all that. Yes, they own the brand, but so do the people that buy it. And if you don't consider your buyers, your users, your audiences, co-owners of your brand, you've lost all control, because all it will take is a 20-year-old who's got a very good idea on TikTok, and they can take your brand under overnight because you have not respected them as co-owners of your brand. When you do it the right way, and I'm not talking about paying people off or affiliate marketing or anything like that, but understanding that if you're a fan of any brand, and that brand could be a sports team, just think about your favorite football club. If that team ever forgets about the fans in the stands, they've lost their brand. The second they return the respect back to the fans in the stands and bring them into the conversation, and as not financial owners, but more importantly, emotional owners of the club, then you will have that multi-generation fan base that grandpa goes to the game with dad and all the kids, and they're going to take their kids, and we will never talk about our rivals because they've been our rivals for five generations, and we will always, always be true to our team, even if they're losing.
Yeah.
I grew up here in Wisconsin. We have football teams, American football team, a very famous one called the Green Bay Packers. When I was growing up, the Green Bay Packers were terrible. They were terrible. I mean, we're talking like 20 years. And the thing is, the Green Bay Packers were the best team in the National Football League about in the 1950s. Vince Lombardi was the big coach. Bart Starr was the quarterback, the big player, the Messi of the day and all that. Well, then they were terrible. But guess what? They had such fans that they stayed with them. The other key thing, especially for the Green Bay Packer brand, back in the early days of the National Football League, Green Bay is the third largest city in Wisconsin, which is like makes them the, I don't know, 500th largest city in the United States. How do they have a national football team? You know, how is that possible? Well, the answer is in the 1950s, when they were short on money, they put out individual shares that anybody could buy. So every member who wanted to back in the 1950s could buy one share of the team, which makes the Green Bay Packers the only team in the United States of America National Football League that cannot be moved someplace else because they are owned by literally the fans in the stands. So long-winded answer to your question, but brands can have a lot of control over their brand when you include all the brand owners in your calculations. And you know, that's what I'm advising people to do, on top of the fact that you have to stick to the nonfiction brand foundation that made those fans loyal in the first place.
Well, I think perhaps a good example of that in the would be in the luxury sector, which would be Louis Vuitton and what's the other, the champagne brand, Dom Perignon, with their neon labels and that. And especially with the likes of Louis Vuitton bringing in these new young designers and styles, but keeping, obviously, to the traditional roots of the quality, the craft, but and maintaining the standard range, but offering this younger generation something they want: sneakers, backpacks, caps, ridiculous thing, phone covers, etc., in weird and wonderful colors, but not alienating the hardcore Louis Vuitton fans.
There's an analogy that I use so that people really understand the difference between brand and trendy colors or ideas, memes or whatever. Brand is the cake. All that other stuff is the frosting. We call it frosting here in the United States. The covering, the fondant, the outside of the cake. You can do whatever you want with the outside, but you don't mess with the cake. Your brand is your cake. It's got to be the same recipe and it has to be true. It has to be authentic. It has to be, dare I say, nonfiction. Yeah. Do you see how that ties all together?
I see what you did there. Now, DP, we could, I think, gab on for quite a while, but I think we might have to have another session to talk brands again and a couple of more stories, and maybe we'll leave Coca-Cola out of it and try and bring in some other
absolutely.
Brands.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry.
But they're always a good example, and we must never forget that there's a new generation of marketers, communicators, and brand folks who've never heard these stories. So we older bucks, you know, need to tell these old war stories to keep the history of these brands alive.
Well, and there are so many new brands that are absolutely embracing. They don't know it because I don't think they know about the whole nonfiction brand coining or framing that I've come up with, but they are absolutely nonfiction brands. And what I would encourage this audience to do is to think about, okay, who in my universe of brands, which are the fictional brands and which are the nonfiction brands? there's almost one perfect way to tell you which is which. Would you recommend it to your best friend or your grandmother? if it is a brand that you would recommend to your beloved grandmother, who's doesn't have a lot of money, who wants really good stuff, and you feel comfortable recommending it to her, it's a nonfiction brand.
Okay, but DP, now you're going into my juicy area, which is the real background of brands. So in South Africa, obviously we've got quite a large poor population, and they can't afford to make mistakes when they buy a product. So like your poor grandmother, you can't buy washing up powder that is going to put holes in your clothes just by saving a little bit of money. You'd rather spend on a brand that is slightly more expensive, but is guaranteed by the brand. You know who the brand is. You can complain. You can go back to the producer. You know where it is. And there's a brand. There's a promise, which is the brand, versus something from Wish or some unknown big box brand.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So let's leave it there. I'm going to leave a link for the book in the podcast, and people should go and download that. Oh, look at that. You look very similar to your photo.
Yeah.
Definitely more handsome in real life.
Yeah. By the way, I'm not a raging narcissist. I didn't put my face on the cover of the book except to make a point. You have to embrace the nonfiction brand that you are, or what I like to call the completely true, completely you brand that you already are. And you have to step into the spotlight, especially now in the age of AI. Embrace who you are, humans, because otherwise our AI overlords are going to put you in a farm or a battery farm like the Matrix. Just say.
That's a conversation for another day, because I know we can talk about that for a while. DP, it's been a true pleasure chatting with you and learning about your book and some of your processes, which I think are almost like biblical truths. So, and anyone in branding marketing should take a look at it. Thank you so much, and you have a great weekend.
Thank you so much.
Come chat with Nicholas. He'll listen to you. Then he'll laugh, and then he'll cry with you. It's all in a safe space for you to speak your truth. Oh, come and chat with